Hey, what's going on, guys? It's Jackson, and this is the NBA Action with Jackson podcast. Finally back once again. Today, we're going to be having on Stephen Garner to talk Phoenix Suns, Dallas Mavericks, kind of the all-encompassing thoughts on that series, what we think of them moving forward, and it'll be a lot of fun. Just lots of great basketball talk, lots of X and O's, just getting into the meat of things. Tired of hearing the same old takes from the same old people? Looking to add some humor, culture, and energy to your daily grind? Your search just might be over. At Rise Network, we're a global multimedia platform for the best and most diverse voices in sports, entertainment, and pop culture. Podcasts, streams, articles, reviews, you name it, we do it. Visit at Rise Network US on all social media platforms or visit www.risenetworkus.com for more info. So what are you waiting for? Come on and rise with us. All right. Thanks for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. Excited to finally get the ball rolling on this. I know that we kicked the idea back and forth before the second round, and then me with finals and finishing up school and just everyone being busy all around just kind of kicked it back a bit. But now we're here discussing game six, kind of the series as a whole. Not exactly as all-encompassing as a series preview, but I think that it's been a pretty interesting series from the standpoint of, I do think for the majority of the series, the Suns have looked like the better team. I think that when the series went back to Dallas, I think that they got good threes, of course. They always get good shots with Luka and the shooting around him, and they got a couple other guys like Brunson who are good ball handlers, and Dinwiddie's really struggling, but he can create his own shot too. I thought that once it got back to Dallas, it did kind of tilt in their favor a bit, just from the standpoint of they're the type of team that they're going to be a little bit streaky. Some of their guys like Bertans are kind of shooter sick characters. They might only get 15, 20 minutes. And if they're missing shots, they're not going to be valuable at all, really. So once they got home, they got some momentum, started playing off it, feeding off it. But I think that the series as a whole has definitely been bent in Phoenix's favor. I just think that Devin Booker looks good. I looked on NBA.com because I was curious, because game six against the Pelicans, he was pretty unassertive, and I was worried if he was still dealing with the hamstring, if he was still hurt, because he only had one drive in that game per the tracking data or whatever on NBA.com. This series, he's up to 12. He's playing great basketball. I think that him and Luka have been in just a complete lockstep battle, and I think that Phoenix is kind of viewing this series as, we have to trust our guys to defend. I think that the contrast and the teams is telling from this standpoint, because they'll put in a switch. They'll have Jay Crowder switch. They'll have DeAndre Ayton switch. And they're largely trusting their guys, because I just want to pull this up really quick. You really don't want to be in a situation where Dallas is getting their catch and shoot threes. DFS is 47% from the series. Kleber is 51%. Reggie Bullock is 36%. Dinwiddie even is 35%. Bertans 58%. So Luka's done a tremendous job getting to the rim at will, 24-ish drives a game. But I think that Phoenix is largely willing to live with that, just from the standpoint that they're not getting killed at the foul line. He's shooting about 46% from the field, 31 from three. They're doing pretty good contesting the step back. And it's a great series by him, not trying to take away from it in any way. But I think that Phoenix basically saying, okay, we know Luka's going to be great. We know he's going to have a tremendous series. We think we're the better team. We're going to trust our guys in space. When we have to rotate, we're going to rotate. Scramble situation, we can scramble and contest, but we can't give up the open corner threes, especially game five, much better job of that. And in the contrast, it's gotten a little bit better as the series has gone on. Phoenix has hunted Luka. Game two was ruthless. And there was even the telling comments from Jason Kidd where he's like, Luka has to participate. It's okay to ask for help, because obviously in the NBA, everyone needs help. But I think that that was kind of code for Luka needs to guard, or they're just going to keep attacking him relentlessly. You're going to get in foul trouble. You're going to get fatigued. And I think that this has just kind of been, this has been the battle of a series with a really good player with the Dallas Mavericks and Luka Doncic, with a pretty good set of teammates, versus the Phoenix Suns, who just have a top to bottom great team. And interestingly enough, they've made some rotation quirks, kind of with the back end of their guard rotation. Campaign's not playing as much as he was last postseason. There's some little subplots with that, but largely this is the same team we saw last year make the finals, go up 2-0 in the finals, and they're playing great basketball. I do think that I lean them for game six, but what are your thoughts on the series and how do you think it projects for the rest of the series?
I think you just did an excellent job pinpointing the things that Dallas has done well, pinpointing the things that obviously Phoenix has done well, and how they've been, you know, engaging in that chess warfare that a competitive postseason series always presents to fans and pundits alike. I think one of the more interesting things for me has been how the Mavericks have challenged the Suns in a way that's unique to what the matchups and everything that, of course, New Orleans was able to present. It's a stark contrast because New Orleans did it from pretty much inside the arc and even more specifically inside the paint and out versus it being outside and in with the Mavericks. So looking at the adjustments that Jason Kidd has made as far as the positioning of his snipers around Doncic, having specific players stationed on the strong side of Doncic and having other guys on the backside and having them incorporate the slightest little bits of movement to touch into their movement shooting. They don't do much off ball screening, which is to the advantage of the Suns, but their shooters and their snipers are so good at spotting up. And even with the slightest bit of movement, that if your help defense is not intact, which is what we saw in games 3 and 4, that can lead to insurmountable amounts of hits from deep. And when you're a team like the Suns and you take a lot of mid-range jumpers and get a lot of points in the paint, you take advantage of that inside the arc a little bit more than you do outside. When you're playing a numbers game against a team that shoots three-pointers on volume, you have to win that battle as far as getting out to the three-point line, running guys off the line, and then being able to not only run them off the line but also recover after that and trust your help defense in general around Luka Doncic, who is a problem in itself. You know, you talked about how they've been doing a good job in containing the ball outside of games 3 and 4, of course. Monty Williams mentioned specifically after game 5 that he was appreciative of the effort that all of their perimeter players that have their chances at guarding Doncic. They did a great job just keeping the ball in front of them. When you keep the ball in front of your man consistently, that also in turn allows for your help defense to trust you enough to where they don't feel the need to overhelp. And overhelping against a playmaker the likes of Luka Doncic is when all hell breaks loose, because it takes nothing but a half second or a half step in positioning, stunting, or even actually legitimately trying to steal a ball from him to where he can whip it right past you. And it's either going to be a tic-tac-toe pass to a three, or it's going to lead to a direct three-pointer. So they've been doing a great job shoring up that after the games 3 and 4 and not over-helping and in positioning, being up the line to take away that passing angle in general. And then, like I said, also trusting up whoever the primary defender is on him, even without a double team. Now, when they send double teams, they were more solid in game 5. It happened seldomly, but they were more solid with the back-end rotations as far as guys being on time and where they're supposed to be with the sharp timing behind it. And they were also able to dislodge the ball a lot, especially in late clock scenarios, which is what the Mavericks pretty much played into, especially at the tail end of the second quarter and into the third quarter for the duration of it, forcing them in a late clock play where they have to either get a quick catch and shoot off under the rest of the clock, or the Suns with Doncic, they were able to dislodge the ball or disrupt his timing with his dribble to take his eye off the basket and then force up the shots that they don't really want to take. Now, he was able to hit a few of those, but for the most part, they weren't going down with the frequency that they would like. So all of those things kind of tilted the scale in favor of the Suns and also allowed for them to, in turn, play going into offense with rhythm after stops. That's where they push the pace. That's where they get into their free-flowing play where Aiden's setting these screens, whether it's a double drag or a single screen, and then they're able to manipulate switching system that the Mavericks use to either get to high-low looks, get Devin Booker to the mid-range and let him get to his spots and play, or obviously Chris Paul to get to his spots and play. And then that in turn allows for them to snowball into flow, getting guys cutting back doors, slipping screens, hitting spot-up shots, the ball movement that they're accustomed to. It's like all those things, but everything's predicated off of their defense. Once they reestablish themselves on that end, especially in the second quarter, I knew that this team was back to playing pretty much the on-brand basketball that you mentioned that got this team up to on the NBA Finals last season.
That's a great point about playing off stops, especially game five. I thought that Phoenix would force a miss or force a turnover, and then Devin Booker just went to work. You mentioned how they're going to set a drag screen or a double drag oftentimes off a missed shot, semi-transition, and seemingly every single time when Devin Booker comes off, he can get a good mid-range shot. He hit a couple pull-up threes. The third quarter, I tweeted this earlier, it felt like they had team takeover from 2K where they were just dominant. They literally took it to the Mavericks. And in the third quarter, that game was still neck and neck. It was contested. It was a pretty evenly matched first half. And Dallas Mavericks got the first crack. Phoenix Suns came back, and they just came out of halftime and just played off their stops. And once Booker gets going, it was a little bit of a ho-hum game from Chris Paul, but then you see Mikal Bridges slipping back for a cut. Cameron Johnson getting an open catch and shoot look. Biombo gets a rim roller. Biombo or Ayton gets an offensive rebound. And then I just think that it's a testament, one, to how good Devin Booker is. I think that the biggest thing with his game is he always gets, you know, 16, 18, 20 shots. He's never passive, but I think that he always gets it in a way where you're like, oh, Devin Booker shot that many times. Like, it's a good balance of he's maintaining the aggression versus there's so much room for everyone else on the team to kind of slot in perfectly to their role, because you just look at their playoff rotation where they have guys like Mikal Bridges, Cameron Johnson, Jay Crowder. Basically all of those guys are in the perfect roles for their game. And then even below that, with the two bigs off the bench, McGee and Biombo, if either of those guys slots in, there's some comfort there. And then Chris Paul, who's at this point probably the perfect sidekick in the NBA. If he needs to take control of a game for 4 to 6 minutes in the fourth, he can do that. Otherwise, he's comfortable just playing off Devin Booker. I think that maybe the year before, Monty, but at least since the 1920 season, Booker has just completely mastered playing within Monty Williams' kind of scheme and offense, where they do so much out of the elbows. He's a willing screener. A lot of times he'll start the possession off ball, get into some movement, catch, and then get into a ball screen. I think that that's big from the standpoint of, yes, you're going to deal with some physicality off the ball. Yes, you have to run to get open, but it's not as draining as dribbling the ball for the entire shot clock. Like you mentioned, Dallas getting into late clock with Luka. A lot of times, if you're taking 6, 8, 10 dribbles, you're going to be tired. The defense is going to be locked in on you, literally looking at you, waiting for your next move to pounce. And then if you pass to a shooter, they can stunt. The shooter hesitates. They got to move the ball or put up a bad shot that's kind of contested. So I think that this has been a good series. I've been pretty satisfied with it. My original pick was Phoenix in 7 because I thought they were going to lose game one because I was worried about Booker. But now, just kind of my evaluation of the series, I think they are better. I think Dallas is a worthy opponent, but I think that we've seen just when Phoenix is clicking, I think they have enough answers for the Mavericks. They're not going to stop Luka, but they can pretty much contain most everyone else. I've been pretty impressed with how they defended Jalen Brunson. They've turned the water off on Spencer Dinwiddie. There's pretty much no low-hanging fruit rim rolls for Dwight Powell. And yeah, I don't even know who they're going to try and dust off for game 6. We'll see if they have anything else up their sleeve, but I've been satisfied with the series. I think that it's shown kind of what Phoenix is and what they will be in the next round, assuming they move on. You never want to get too, you don't want to assume too much, but I do think that they win game 6, and I do think that they'll be in the conference finals. And I think I would lean them in that series, but zooming out, what is your kind of view of the team and their standing in the league? Let's assume that they win game 6 or win game 7 and move on. Do you think that this team is set up to compete just like last year? Because I don't want to get cliche or make the boring pick, but I do think that they'll be right back where they were last season. And I had a brief moment of kind of doubt with the Booker hamstring injury. I was like, ooh, I thought they were going to get by the Pelicans, but that's a tough injury. I mean, we've seen Jaylen Brown have bouts with it. Obviously, Harden's taken a hit this year. There's been countless other players. Even his teammate Chris Paul has had hamstring issues in the past, but he hasn't missed a beat. He looks great. And I think that this team, if you say they're the best team in basketball, you can't argue it, especially with the way everyone else is playing, the way that Milwaukee and Boston are just beating the crap out of each other in a slugfest defensive bout out east. And then, you know, respect to Miami, they're playing really good basketball. I just think that they're a notch below kind of what Phoenix is. So I think they've been the best team in basketball this season. I think they make the finals. I don't know who I would pick in the finals, but that's kind of my read on them. Now that Booker's healthy, they've checked that box. We'll see what happens with kind of their back end of the rotation. They haven't gotten much from Aaron Holiday, and Cameron Payne got his minutes slashed. So we'll see what happens with guys like Shamet and whatnot. But like 1-7, 1-8, this team is so good. They have several players that are reliable starters that you're comfortable both guarding, taking three-point looks off the catch. And I feel like Cameron Johnson is a guy who is also expanding his game, similarly to how Mikal Bridges did a year or two ago. But what is your kind of stance on this team's season moving forward?
I feel like they're perfectly positioned and primed to do, like you mentioned, exactly what they did last season, but get over that hump this time. They've had the internal growth of their drafted homegrown pieces and DeAndre Ayton for one, showing the growth and attention to detail that he has now on the offensive end, being able to get to his specific spots, do so via dribble, which is something that he showed in college but didn't show much in the NBA last season specifically and earlier this season. But as the seasons went on, he's been able to kind of navigate without needing somebody to pass him open to get to his spots in the mid-range, around the elbows, and from the free throw line and in to get to those soft touch jumpers, the floaters, the unprecedented hook shot that's eerily reminiscent of 1990s and before basketball. And then he's also been really good on the short roll as far as his decision-making. You know, a lot of big men, when they get the ball in the short roll, they're not natural playmakers. So they're trained and almost conditioned to make that pass to go automatically to the strong side corner or to the weak side corner. Whereas with Aiden, he's become so accustomed and built up so many reps in doing so that now you see him kind of pause, or he has a feel for where the help defenders are around him. So those passes aren't premeditated. He's reading and reacting in the moment. So you're seeing like his processing speed slowly begin to come together. And that's a whole nother entity of the offense that's beginning to unlock. Because at some point, teams are going to have to start double-teaming Devin Booker and Chris Paul coming off of ball screens. That's just an inevitable part of the game. You have to keep playmakers and just players in general of that elite caliber. You have to keep them on a string in some sense to give them something to think about with scheme versatility. So putting two on the ball in different ways and forcing the ball out of their hands a little earlier than normal is naturally going to put DeAndre Ayton in playmaking scenarios. And he's shown especially against the Pelicans, not as much against the Mavericks, but he's still shown it in spurts, that he has a propensity to making not just a good read, but the correct read. The pass to the short corner is always going to be there, but that doesn't mean it's always supposed to be the pass that you're supposed to make. He's attacking out of that. He's getting it to the wing instead of the corner, which is going to either force another rotation or hit a shooter that's wide open. It's allowing the offense to generate a whole lot more flow, again, independent of Devin Booker or Chris Paul, which is just naturally just making their offense that much more all-encompassing. And then you spoke about Devin Booker and his growth offensively this postseason. So he's averaging 26.8 points. He's shooting, is it 40, like 48% from
the field. He's having an insane series. Like his shooting splits are dang near 50-50-90.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I forgot exactly what his catch and shoot and pull-up numbers were specifically, but they're well north of what the average is for even a player of his caliber that's taking the amount of shots that he is. Like, he's just doing everything. But my most favorite thing about his game, because we knew he could do those things with the ball, and I'm dating it back to when he had those years that he spent as the point guard and the primary ball handler on teams.
The Tyler Ulis years.
Yeah, the Ulis years before Rubio and everything. So looking back at those years, he's taking all those reps that he had as the primary ball handler and point guard, and he's applying them now. He's just his processing speed and his patience and just understanding of what defenses are trying to do to him schematically, and also understanding the strengths and weaknesses of his teammates around him, knowing the positions to put them in, and getting the ball to them on time and target for them to make the next play. It's just been beautiful to see his game just continue to evolve. You mentioned him working off the ball instead of bringing the ball up the court, having a CP3 or a Jay Crowder or Mikal Bridges that can bring the ball up the floor. So in those specific sets, when they run their Chicago and Miami actions, when he's starting off the ball and he's receiving down screens that lead to dribble handoffs, that's Chicago. He's reading the defense that the Mavericks are putting on him. Typically, when they're in their starting lineup, is Dwight Powell. He's usually more so leaning towards like playing a little bit at the level or like a short drop. But after game one this series, he was putting a lot more pressure on the ball, showing and recovering or showing and trapping. So Devin Booker, in turn, was reading that specifically before he even got the ball in his dribble handoffs. I did a breakdown on it on Twitter. And you can watch him reading as Aiden rolls to the basket after the dribble handoff. Okay, Powell's arm's length away from me. There's no way he's contesting this alley-oop to Aiden. So they went to the oop about two or three times in game one. And then they went to it again in game two. And in game three and four, the Mavericks made, of course, adjustments to that. And they started showing for either a trap to take the ball completely out of his hands and take that passing angle away. Or they started playing with the help from the low man at the box on the opposite side of the action and kind of giving him different looks. But he was always making the correct read time and time again. Now, there was one pass that he threw, I believe it was game four. It was a one-handed alley-oop, which is typically not what he does. But that pass ended up going off the backboard. It was Aaron. But outside of that, you know, his turnovers haven't been at an alarming rate. He's making the correct reads. And he's just showing his overall growth as a player as a whole. Offensively and even more so defensively with his positioning. He's playing without fouling, which is what you want most out of your superstars. He's diving on the floor for loose balls, going out of bounds to save possessions. He's doing all those little things that when your top players do it, it just kind of trickles down the rest of the roster. And he's just gotten so much better, man, so much better. It's been a beautiful thing to see. And you add to that the growth of Cam Johnson, who's extremely underrated by the masses. He finished, was it top three in sixth man of the year voting, which I felt like was appropriate. That dude is just the ultimate glue guy. He has the punch offensively to punch well past the fifth or fourth option on any given night to be a number two or number three, but he plays his role to a T. He understands positioning and he understands lifting and sinking with his movement shooting. He does a great job ghosting and screening and rolling. When they need him to do that, to manipulate switches. He does a great job playing in space. Him and Jay Crowder have, and as well as Mikal Bridges, as you mentioned, all three of them, they have this little dynamic where they'll flow behind Chris Paul and Devin Booker whenever they're driving to the basket, whether it's off a screen or if it's off just an isolation play. They'll kind of trail in that same direction, like above the arc, going over to the slot or going to the top of the key. It's kind of like a banana cut. And they'll do it going full speed. And Booker,
like 45 cut at the angle.
Nah, it's less of a 45 because they're literally trailing around the 3-point line. So it's like a banana cut. It's like curvy. Mm-hmm. And those two will find them in stride. And that's putting stress on the nail help that's traveling behind those two with the ball. And that puts them in a tough situation because they're out of position. 9 times out of 10, either that leads to a foul or they get a drive to the basket, getting attempted up at the rim. So it's like those little things that where their continuity and chemistry just in general is just growing. And it's to the point where it's kind of like with the Warriors at their peak, all their players just know how to play off of each other. They're just a well-oiled machine and they're just getting the job done with time on task across the board all over.
That's a great point. I thought that in game five, I was curious how the Suns would come out and play. And I just felt like it was possession after possession, just bink, boom. Extra pass, good to great shot, every single trip down. To kind of peel back to the Ayton point, you mentioned the short roll. I feel like a lot of bigs, like the vast majority, if the weak side is pulled in and help, they'll either catch the ball and crash into him, or they'll just make that premeditated cookie cutter kind of kick to the corner. And then every team is basically conditioned to just X out and rotate to it. A lot of teams will be able to take that away. But with Ayton, he can make kind of the patience of just letting it come to him where there'll be two on the ball, whether it's a hedge or a trap, he'll catch, he'll turn, and he'll just decisively make a play off it. And then, as you said, the hook shot is incredible. He has to shoot like 60% on that thing. It's crazy. Sometimes I find myself thinking like, Ayton, please dunk the ball. he doesn't shoot too many free throws, but then it's like, who am I to complain? He's literally cashed with that. And as you mentioned, Devin Booker, you just alluded to his patience as a player and his overall growth. And the way I've kind of viewed it is just no wasted movement in his game. I think that this bodes well for him, not only beating defenses, you said staying out of foul trouble, but just conserving energy, being able to play injured. He's probably not 100% right now, but we haven't been able to kind of tell because he's playing so well and just everything is coming in the flow at the same time. He's able to leave his imprint on the game, but just a great team to watch. I wanted to kick a couple questions off you. When Cameron Johnson came into the league, he was kind of like an old shooting prospect, like senior. I think he was a grad transfer from like Pittsburgh to North Carolina. Yep. And people viewed him as just a shooter. But I think that he's shown that he's a diverse shooter. He can do it versus a contest. You said he can lift. And then a lot of guys, they can just shoot the catch and shoot shot, you know, hit it 37% of the time. Not everyone can move, relocate, catch, and splash. He can do that. And then I started to kind of wonder this during their run last year, in transition especially. He's pretty athletic with runouts. He'll dunk the ball on occasion, and I'm pretty impressed. And I think that some of that trust has even bled into defensively. They don't treat him like a poor defender within their own team. Like Monty Williams trusts him, his teammates trust him. I'm not saying that he's as good as Bridges or Jay Crowder defensively, but he holds up just fine. So have you kind of seen similar growth path for him to where he was kind of put into a box as a shooter, but he is so much more than that? Like his next contract will be pretty big, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I've been one of the leaders on the Cam Johnson fandom train this season. That dude is just showing growth in so many different ways. We can start with his shooting. So yeah, I mentioned that he's a relocation master. He does a great job sinking. He does a great job lifting. He just does a great job like understanding spacing, even like the slightest bit of steps to the left or to the right when his man's not paying attention to help to create that angle for him to get off his quick release. Those little things always add up, especially when you slow the game down in the playoffs. And he has an elite understanding of just all those off-ball dynamics that you need to get your shot off and get your shot off consistently. And of course, he knocks it down at a league top rate. I believe he finished third or fourth this season in a three-point field goal percentage on a high volume as well, behind the likes of Luke Kennard. So, you know, he's in that realm. He's in that ilk of shooters, and he has the versatility as a shooter, as you mentioned, to do so in a multitude.
He's big too. He's tall for a wing forward type.
Like 6'8", yeah. So it's hard to contest his shot, even if you are getting a good closeout, because it's coming from an extremely high peak, you know. And then adding to his offense, he's added just a depth understanding of how to play off ball as far as cutting. Whether it's cutting to get himself open and create offense or cutting to get another teammate open as like a function of the half-court offense. He has a good understanding of doing that. He's also added a strong handle and even more so specifically attacking closeouts. So, of course, he's going to be in a scenario where a guy's going to be closing out long to him. So he's going to have a solid handle to not just get past the defender, but to create offense off of that. So this season he did a great job and upping the frequency of his attempts on drives, getting to the basket and finishing around the basket. His finishing rate went up a few percentage points this season. And also, he's very quietly added a mid-range jumper to his entire offensive attack. I believe he showed it last game, actually. There was a scenario where he was on the right wing, caught a pass. Of course, his man was supposed to run him off the line, which he did. He took two dribbles to the left, did a little step back, and hit a pull-up jumper around the nail. So it's just all these little parts of growth for him on top of his transition game, changing ends of the floor. He's earned enough trust from Chris Paul and Devin Booker and Cameron Payne as well to receive those hit-ahead passes on the sideline to then create offense for himself. And I even had a thread of plays from this season alone where he's done the grab and go, where he grabs rebound because, again, we talked about his stature. He'll grab the board and just go coast to coast, like no passes. He'll look guys off. I believe it was against either San Antonio or Minnesota. He looked off Chris Paul, who was trying to get an outlet pass to start the offense, He ended up going coast to coast, and he got like a crazy M1 finish. And the play-by-play team ran it back, and they showed Chris Paul's reaction. And he just kind of saw his eyes go, and it was like one of those coming full circle moments where he's like, okay, he really got a feel for this handling the ball in transition. So he just had a lot of little points like that this season on the offensive end where they've shown his growth. And then defensively, as you mentioned, he spent, I want to say, outside of Mikal Bridges, as much time as anybody guarding guarding Luka Doncic. And that's because, of course, he's being hunted out when CP3 is not on the floor. And he's did a solid job of holding his own. He's good with his positioning. He keeps the ball in front of him. And then when he's off the ball, he does a great job and help as far as being a glue guy. I'll be having like a little thread up later on today on Twitter. But there's two specific plays where the ball got swung from the strong side to the weak side, putting guys in closeout situations. And he's doing the peel switch where on the drive, he's just taking the angle away from the driver. And the guy who was original man is driving the ball, peels back to, you know, take his guy. And he did it twice. He did it once with Devin Booker and did it another time with DeAndre Ayton. Both times ended up in turnovers. I believe he forced both. One was a strip and then the other one was like a block shot at the rim. And he just does all these little things to where he's like that blue chip player that you need that's not necessarily a starter, but he's like a sixth starter, which is what Monty Williams coined him this past season. And he just does all those little things. He can always come in and close depending on what the game demands in place of Jay Crowder at times. And he just does everything that you need out of a role player. And yes, he's got a big bag coming his way soon too.
Yeah, for sure. I hope that the Suns retain him. It'll be interesting to kind of see their offseason because Ayton restricted free agent, Cam Johnson extension eligible. I hope they keep the core together because I think that this is something where Chris Paul is obviously eventually going to age, although he's one of those players that I don't ever anticipate being bad, you know? I think that he's always going to be just like, how is he still doing this at this age? Like Chris Paul will be in his age 40 season and he'll average like 13-8 and he'll shoot like 53% from the floor. And we'll be like, how the hell is he doing this? But yep. No, but a couple things I wanted to ask you before we kind of make our grandstanding predictions on this series and moving forward is I kind of wanted to get your opinion on some of the dilemmas, right, if you want to call it that, with the Phoenix rotation. We've seen both of JaVale McGee and Bismack Biyombo this postseason. How do you think what do you think goes into Monty Williams' kind of mind when he's deciphering which of those to play? Because both have been pretty tremendous this season for what they were expected to do. McGee, free agency signing. He's been there the whole year. And I believe Biyombo was a COVID replacement at first, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then
yeah,
he,
over 10 days, yeah.
Yeah, then he stuck. That. So do you have a preference between the two? Do you trust both of them? What do you think Monty Williams is kind of looking at when he decides which one to go with? Sometimes he goes with both too. Mm-hmm. Not at the same time, but in the same game.
So I don't necessarily have a preference between the two because they both, which is what you want, they're kind of similar in a sense, but they also have contrasting dynamics about them. Obviously, JaVale's more inclined to the offensive end outside of blocking shots. And obviously, Bismack's more inclined to the defensive end and doing those little things and what Monty Williams calls multiple efforts. He's a master of all of those things. So when you kind of bring them all together in tandem with DeAndre Ayton, you have a dynamic trio of centers that's unique to the league because most teams only have one traditional big man on their roster nowadays. And they have three, and they know how to deploy them all. And all three know how to play in various scenarios, you know, in a conducive team winning environment. So as far as specifically with Biyombo and McGee, I feel like Monty deploys them kind of based on checking the temperature of the game. So if he sees that like we've seen earlier in this series with the Mavericks, they're putting JaVale McGee in scenarios to where he has to close out to the three-point line. And he's kind of reluctant to leave that porch out of his drop coverage, his deep drop coverage. And it gets to the point where it's beginning to hurt the team as far as Cleaver going off for five threes in the quarter or anything of that nature. Or if they're manipulating switches, you naturally taper back his minutes and you put Biyombo in. You're sacrificing a little bit of your offense, but you're getting more stops because you can apply a more versatile scheme defensively with Bismack Biyombo. He's not necessarily more fleet of foot than JaVale is, but he's more coordinated and moving around in space and doing so without fouling. So you can put him up at the level of the screen. You can put him in a short drop. You can put him in a deep drop. You can put him in trapping scenarios. You can trust him one-on-one far more than you can with Doncic than you can with, of course, JaVale McGee. So putting that dynamic into it all and kind of looking at the two and comparing, that's when you have like perfect mesh where the coach has options. Optionality isn't always the best thing to have in the playoffs because you can't, there's only so many minutes and your rotations aren't that long. But when you have that perfect marriage to where you can say, okay, hey, JaVale, I'm going to cut your 12 or 14 minutes in half. We're going to split it with Bizzy. And then we're going to let both your dynamics play out in the outcome of the game whenever DeAndre Ayton's sitting or he's in foul trouble. You know, then you create, like I said, that perfect marriage. And then you have a perfect stopgap to where if Ayton is in foul trouble, you don't have to necessarily worry about losing production because you have these guys that can do similar things to him outside of scoring and creating offense for themselves. So I think it's a perfect marriage. It's an extremely unique dynamic, and this one is going to end up paying big dividends for them if they get back to the finals and they get the matchup that I'm expecting them to get in the finals.
Who do you expect, Bucks?
Yeah.
I was thinking the winner of the Bucks-Celtics series probably beats the winner of the Miami-Philly series. That's just kind of my from a distance view. But I like what you said about JaVale McGee. He's the lob threat. He's usually in that deep drop, like way around the charge circle. Like he'll drop way back. Biyombo, there's going to be some more scheme versatility. What's interesting about Biyombo is I always thought that he had some horrible hands, but I think that he's actually been a really good fit with Chris Paul. And I don't know if it's just Chris Paul is going to hit the pocket pass perfectly. And he has just an array of bounce feeds and just wraparound passes that he can put on guys. And that's making Biyombo catch the ball better. But that fit has worked out tremendously. And it got me thinking, just kind of prepping for the podcast, I was thinking like Phoenix has a borderline all-star center, and then they have two other guys on the bench that they can trust. And I root for Minnesota a lot of the time. Naz Reid, he had a good season. He's a pretty good young player. He struggled big time against Memphis, just got killed on the glass, just not quite athletic enough to deal with, Brandon Clark and XTS isn't very athletic, but just some of the issues in that series came up. And I was like, dang, he's a talented player. And he had some issues against Memphis. And then here's the Phoenix Suns with two centers they can kind of trust and rely on. Most teams, if you have a good starting center, a lot of teams just say whatever and get like a guy on the minimum. Mm-hmm. And then that player is usually not very good, but the Suns mm-hmm. have two guys that you could say, okay, if they play 12 to 16 minutes, we're not screwed. One more quick question kind of on the Phoenix Suns rotation that I got to thinking about last game when Cam Payne has really struggled this playoffs, didn't play too much in game 5. Of this kind of bunch between Cam Payne, Aaron Holiday, and then kind of the wing types, I don't even know if you would consider Torrey Craig and Ish Wainwright wings. They're almost like kind of fours in my mind. I don't really consider them to be wings, but of those kind of deep bench guys, Monty has kind of leaned on them all at various points of his tenure, but he's also gone away from them. And what I like about Monty Williams is he'll play whoever is the best for the matchup. And I think that keeps guys engaged. It means you're going to play 11 or 12 guys in a year, but in a matchup, you're only going to play 8 or 9, but it keeps everyone ready. So just moving forward for the rest of the season, I know Craig has had some health issues, unless I'm mistaken, but which of those kind of four players do you think is most likely that if we're talking about a conference finals series or an NBA finals series, like, oh, Torrey Craig has been insane this game 5, or Cameron Payne had 14 points and 3 assists in this game 4. Who do you think will, if any of them, are most likely to kind of resurface?
I feel like the natural progression to putting Shamet in that backup point guard role, which we saw in game 5, it was kind of inevitable because the writing's been on the wall as far as the production and the space that Cameron Payne's been in this season. He's really struggled with his touch and feel as far as – he's not a natural point guard in any sense of the word, but he struggled with his touch and feel as far as getting the others in that second unit involved. And that was one of the most important dynamics of that championship that championship caliber team of last season. His production, scoring, and being able to get those guys involved off the bench was you really couldn't even put a value on that. And that's been lacking at varying points this season. He's had some ups, but the downs have been a lot more loud and resounding and a lot more sustained than the ups have been. So I was really hoping that he would be able to develop that chemistry to where he would at least be able to have that pick and roll threat with JaVale McGee. They've shown it in very varying spurts throughout the season, but his consistency just hasn't been there. So in that group of players, excluding Shamit, because I feel like he'll be in a rotation the rest of the way, I feel like it'll be Torrey Craig because of the veteran experience he has. He has the versatility to play small ball five if they need to, which they did a few times last playoffs when they had Dario Saric as the backup big. And, you know, Craig was able to – he was able to make things happen against the Clippers and then, of course, in the finals against the Bucks. So I feel like just kind of off of just an understanding that he's a veteran, he's been there before, and they have the prerequisite wet reps and the sweat equity built up to where there's understanding and there's trust in his placement in the rotation when he's able to come back. I feel like he'll be the one in that group of guys that's going to be like an X factor in a sense because, you know, when you go against a team, like let's assume the Warriors win this series with the Grizzlies and the Suns win, of course, let's assume that. If they meet up, you have to have guys that are versatile enough to go from guarding Steph Curry to go to guarding a Klay Thompson or go guarding Draymond Green, understanding what to do when you're guarding a Draymond Green. And then you might end up switching on to Jordan Poole to end that possession. That's four different switches in one possession. And, you know, that's four completely different defensive roles that you have to be trusted in, you know, be active in, effective in. So I feel like it'll be Torrey Craig for sure.
I like that a lot. One last thing before we go, I won't ask you to make a finals prediction or anything crazy like that, but who do you think wins game six? Who do you think wins the series? And then if you think the Suns win the series, which we talked about it before, I think we both imagine the Suns win game six. And if not, I definitely would like their chances in a game seven at home. Not to jump the gun or get ahead of ourselves, but I do think that they're the better team and will take care of business. So, first, your prediction, and then beyond that, what is one thing you'll be watching versus the Warriors and one thing you'll be watching versus the Grizzlies, just to kind of cover all of our bases on potential matchups?
For sure. So, yes, I do have the Suns winning this series in six. I do feel like kind of just looking back at last season, they close out series on the road with consistency. Like, they won their first round series against the Lakers on the road. Devin Booker had a crazy historic type game six performance at Staples Center going to the second round against the Nuggets.
They destroyed them in like the second quarter, right? And with the Lakers matchup, yeah, that was a fun game, to be honest.
Yeah, it was. And it was crazy because Devin Booker was doing it in the house that Kobe built. So you got all those parallels and everything being drawn in his first playoffs in Graciation, you know. So you move on to the second round, they close out the Nuggets on the road in game four. And then you move on to the third round, they close out the Clippers on the road in game six. It was Chris Paul and Devin Booker really taking the forefront and tapping into their inner sicko and just completely just taking over the game, and blowing up whatever schemes the opposing teams were trying to put against them, completely scrapping it and just saying, you're going to take these buckets and we're going to lead our team to the next round. And they've shown a propensity for doing that. And, you know, Chris Paul showed it most recently in game six against the Pelicans. A perfect shooting night. Like, that's just the style of players that they are in these closeout scenarios. And with both of them being healthy too right now and having the underwhelming showings that they had collectively in games three and four, I'm expecting them to come back with this next opportunity on the road in Dallas and kind of make amends for those things and end this series in six and do so in a loud, resounding fashion as well, and as a tandem.
Yeah. With the Suns, I feel like every time there's been a dilemma with them, like, are they really going to beat the Lakers? Oh my gosh, Chris Paul has COVID. Devin Booker hurt his hamstring. Can they even hang on versus the Pelicans? Oh my goodness, it's 2-2 versus the Mavs. What's going to happen in game five? Every single time, more or less, they've answered the call. I know they lost the finals, but winning is hard. Somebody has to lose. But time and time again, the Suns have showed, I don't want to say backs against the wall because they're up 3-2, but when they're pressed, when they get bent, when it's must win, take care of business time, when it's winning time, they kind of have the answer. But tremendous team. What's one thing you're just watching with either of the Warriors and the Grizzlies? Just one thing you'd be looking forward to for each of those teams with a potential conference final series?
So that matchup with the Grizzlies, I'll be looking at that play in the paint because, of course, they're an inside-out team. They're a new version of an inside-out team with the pressure point that is John Morant. If and when he's healthy, getting to the paint, scoring in the paint, generating offense through paint touches, whether it's him or it's Jaren Jackson Jr. So looking at that matchup, it would be who's going to win that points in the paint battle because the Suns like to play in what Monty calls paint to great, whether it's getting paint touches that lead to offense or paint touches that lead to other actions that getting a better shot. Looking at the matchup there to see who would win that battle and points in the paint and who would just be better at walling off the paint and blocks and elbows and forcing the opposition to play from the outside in. And then versus the Warriors, I'll be looking specifically at the just in general, the off-ball defense, because as we know, they're one of the best teams ever as far as taking what you have habit-wise defensively and using it against you. So when guys fall asleep when that first pass goes to the wing and the person that made the pass then comes behind your head and the pass is already there before you turn your head and the rest of the help defense isn't even in position yet, they do that so consistently. It's like the Spurs, essentially. So watching that battle, and the Suns have been really good at their off-ball defense, but, of course, that tests you to a complete different magnitude than any other comparison can. So that would be the matchup that I'm looking at with that matchup with the Warriors, as well as what can DeAndre Ayton do against the one man center lineups with Looney and them using small.
That'll be awesome. Yeah, I think Ayton would have success even against Draymond. Mm-hmm. I think that I don't know. I think I look at a Warriors matchup. I think there will be instances where they would try and put two on the ball, and there'll be instances where they would just try and switch it, but. The thing with the Warriors, there's no chance they're going to switch Steph, Poole onto DeAndre Ayton unless there's just an easy scram kickout switch right there. So I think that they would really ramp up the aggression. They hedge their guards all the time. So that'd just be something to watch. That'd be a really fun series. That's, I don't know. I'm kind of rooting for the Grizzlies to quote unquote do the impossible just with John Morant being downed and all the fallout from that series. But just like, competition wise, I do think the best series, assuming that Morant's still out, would probably be Suns Warriors. And right now I'd probably lean Suns, but I'd have to watch some of the regular season matchups back. I know that last one in Golden State was such a defensive grind, but I don't really know how much you can take from that game when I think who was out for that game. Was that a game Curry missed?
Steph was out that game and then Devin Booker missed the game.
So yeah. So it'll be a fun series, but I want to thank you for coming on. You really knocked it out the park. This has been one of my favorite episodes. It's always tricky to do like a team centric episode because I don't want to like misspeak or say anything wrong. And to have you on, who you're clearly an expert on the game and an expert on the Suns, and you just delivered 10 times over.
I appreciate it, man. Likewise, you know a lot yourself, honestly, even though you're not focusing specifically on them. You know, you hit on a lot of things that a lot of people who kind of watch them from afar don't necessarily notice. So this was definitely a fun conversation to have. I appreciate your time and, you know, for the invite to come on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, assuming the Suns move on, I'd love to have you on some point again next round.
Yes, sir. Let's work, man. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.
All right, you too.
Thanks again to Steven for coming on the show. I cannot wait to have him back on, hopefully in the near future. That was honestly one of my favorite episodes. Just anytime you're doing a deep dive on a team, kind of a team-centric episode, you're kind of worried about how it goes, the work you put in, and then who you bring on to discuss it. But as you guys can tell, he is an expert not only on the Phoenix Suns, but the game of basketball itself. And I've really enjoyed getting to know him over the past few weeks. So make sure you guys check out his Twitter, everything in his link tree. He makes great content. I'll be back again real soon, guys. Peace.